This is The Guardian.
Today, both the government and the Met Police are launching inquiries after Sarah Everard was murdered by a serving officer. Will that be enough to restore women's trust in the police? Last week, Sarah Everard's family faced her killer, Wayne Cousins, in court and addressed him for the first time. Her mother, Susan, said, "I think of Sarah all the time, but the mornings and evenings are particularly painful. In the morning, I wake up to the awful reality that Sarah is gone. In the evenings, at the time she was abducted, I let out a silent scream. Don't get in the car, Sarah. Don't believe him." The reason Sarah believed him was because, as we learned for the first time last week, he used his police ID and handcuffs to falsely arrest her. For Zoe Billingham, who has spent more than a decade exposing misconduct within police forces in her role at Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, the idea that a serving officer could do this was disturbing.
What I wasn't aware of was the circumstances in which he'd used his cloak of a police officer to trick her into his car and handcuffed her. And when I heard that, I felt physically sick.
It's emerged that there were warning signs about Cousins, allegations of indecent exposure, and that his nickname amongst former colleagues was the Rapist. Now police forces across the country are having to reckon with the fact that there may be others like him within their ranks.
He was one of us, and we need to look at ourselves very, very carefully to understand, A, how was he allowed to be one of us, and what does it say about us as an organisation that he was?
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, can women trust the police to protect them? So we were going to talk about whether women can trust the police after what happened to Sarah Everard. And I want to start with looking at the case of the man who killed her. 6 years before he murdered Sarah, he was accused of indecent exposure while working for Kent Police. They're now being investigated by the IOPC, which is the Independent Office for Police Conduct, for how they handled that. Wayne Cousins then went on to join the Met, where it's alleged he exposed himself again just days before killing Sarah. How on earth can an officer continue working when they are accused of committing an offence like this?
Clearly, any allegations of that nature, and this is a really serious allegation, you know, exposure, flashing, it's not no level. We know that people that take those kind of really risky steps to expose themselves in public are people that are likely to have lost their sense of boundaries or perhaps never to have had any boundaries in the first place. And we know that it's a risk factor that could really rapidly escalate. And so immediately something like this happening, I would expect police forces to treat it with the utmost seriousness. I'm not convinced that that happens always. And I'm not convinced that the police are always using all of the tools available to them to actually monitor, check and review the activities of police officers who are, in inverted commas, suspect.
You know, just last week at the London Assembly, Sir Stephen House, who's the Deputy Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, was asked about these allegations. And one of the things he said about Wayne Cousins was that he was off duty when he was alleged to have done this.
He wasn't identified at that time as a police officer.
Okay.
He was off duty and he exposed himself in a commercial setting and it was reported to the police, to the Metropolitan Police Service. And we responded and that case was under investigation when he carried out the abduction, rape and murder of Sarah.
You know, is there perhaps a suggestion here that forces need to reevaluate what a kind of worrying indicative behaviour is? And perhaps also more widely as society, we need to think about this too.
The police are pretty smart generally about being able to identify people who are likely to offend because they have lots of research. There's been lots of cases, sadly, of police officers acting inappropriately and exploiting vulnerable victims for their own sexual gratification. And there's a problem profile. And most forces will know precisely what they ought to be looking for. There is no difference between a police officer being on duty or off duty. The highest standards of behaviours are expected in either scenario. And I'm certain that most other forces in the country would take as seriously an offence, whether committed on or off duty.
Last week, a senior investigating officer on Sarah's case told Sky News that he and his colleagues didn't recognise Sarah's killer as a police officer, but as a murderer.
And it's a really important thing, you know, he doesn't hold the same values as a police officer. He doesn't have the same personality that we do. You know, he's a very sick, very dangerous individual who should never have been near a uniform.
And a lot of people felt this sounded like the Met disavowing responsibility. Is it right that he made out that this was the case of one bad guy?
My view is we can't abide by the narrative that this was a one-off, this was a rarity. We need to treat this as though it might happen again. In fact, I think police systems are such that it could still happen again. We do know from the work that we've done that there are a whole range of referrals to the IOPC, the Independent Office of Police Conduct, for inappropriate behaviours. Nothing, of course, on the scale that we've seen in respect of Cousins, but wholly inappropriate misuse of a position of police officer to abuse and to harm women, and to characterise it as a one-off, and to characterise it as not being a police officer's problem because he shouldn't have been a police officer, I think is probably wrong. And actually, if you look at what police officers are saying on social media as well, male and female officers, a lot of people are saying, you know, we can't pretend it was just that one single problem. We need to accept it was an officer and deal with it. We're never going to get to the heart of it unless we accept that this officer was not only a special in one force, he then went on to be a serving officer in another force and then moved into the Met. And then in the Met, he not only served as an officer, but he also was issued with a firearm.
Let's talk about what you found in your years of investigating police forces. In 2019, you wrote a report which looked into how police abuse their positions for sexual purposes, which is exactly what Wayne Cousins did. What did you find in carrying out that work?
We called the report Shining a Light on Betrayal. And what we found was, although rare, there was still a really worrying number of police officers who were using their position within policing to predate on particularly vulnerable victims. We saw that there were something between 100 and 150 referrals of police officers and police staff into the IOPC a year, and that's a big number. So we know there was a lot of officers and staff who were acting wholly inappropriately. And I heard a testimony direct from victims of domestic abuse, for example, where a police officer turns up, he's kind of knight in shining armour, she's been very badly abused, is very damaged, very frightened. You know, he kind of either says, anytime you want me to support you, I will, or here's my phone number if you need me to call you. If you're feeling scared, give me a shout, you know, giving them his personal number. And he reels them in. You know, from that moment in time, when you're at your most vulnerable as a victim of domestic abuse, you have someone come over your threshold who you think is going to be your saviour, and they have one thing in mind, and that one thing in mind is to abuse you and to ask you to engage in sexual acts with the officer, either on duty or not on duty. And that, and also women sex workers too, would tell us accounts of officers seeking sexual favours in order not to proceed with perhaps a reporting of a particular crime relating to them. Kind of the defining factor that we saw in all of the different cases that we reviewed was police officers really, really singling out women when they're at their lowest ebb to ostensibly on occasions befriend them, or on other occasions to threaten them and hold them to ransom.
What was it like for you working on that report? I mean, it's very, very distressing stuff that you're uncovering.
Yeah, of course. The case that really was the shocking case for me was this police officer. It's in our report. He was in contact with 13 different vulnerable women, all of whom had contacted the police after domestic abuse or harassment, or because they were working in the sex trade. So this individual officer was kind of, you know, he was like a a missile locked onto these individual women. And the thing that was astonishing for me was, in one day alone, while he was on duty, he made 399 contacts with a domestic abuse victim. He contacted another woman 575 times when he was off sick. And then he contacted another victim of domestic abuse 699 times in a little over 2 months. I mean, this is indescribable behaviour. He was obviously bombarding these women with texts. He sent a picture of himself naked, which was taken from within the forced locker room.
Oh, my God.
I mean, honestly, at times, I looked at staff working on this with me. And we just shook our head in utter disbelief.
I mean, all of that is completely horrific, and I can understand why you were so completely angry about it. But how does this happen? I mean, what is the vetting process for officers, and particularly, you know, before they are hired and when they move on to a new force?
The standard police vetting does all the things you'd expect, you know, make sure you're not bankrupt. It will look at social media. It checks for references and so on. But I wonder whether or not there needs to be another long, hard look at whether or not the vetting that police officers have to go through is intrusive enough. What's clear to me at the moment is too many people are getting through the net. Most worrying for me is police officers moving from one force to another were able to do so and just carry over the vetting that they had already in place in their previous force without them being re-vetted. And we knew, we didn't have data on this, but we had anecdotal evidence that a police officer who is about to get caught out will jump before they're caught out. And where will they jump? They'll jump into another force. So it may well be that there's a kind of a bit of a suspicion. Someone's reported them into the professional standards department, the counter-corruption unit. There's some questions being asked by their line manager or supervisor, which puts that predator, because these predators will be really cunning and conniving, puts them on notice to think, uh-oh, they may be onto me, and they'll transfer. So I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that every officer transferring from one force to another is a risk, but we know some of those officers that transfer with a particular profile, middle-aged men, often divorced, sadly, is part of that problem profile. You have to ask yourselves why, and there absolutely must be vetting in place.
And you mentioned bankruptcy. What was interesting, I suppose, in the Wayne Cousins case, he was reportedly in tens of thousands of pounds of debt when he transferred from Kent to the Met. Are financial checks ever made when someone transfers to a new force?
So my understanding is that's a fairly standard and routine check, is the financial status, because basically vetting is there to check out whether there's anything in anyone's history that could make them a risk to the public, but also a risk to being contacted by serious and organised crime and blackmail, basically. And people that are in dire financial straits immediately represent more of a risk.
You wrote that report 2 years ago, though, Zoe, so why is that still not happening?
Well, you know, this isn't the first time we looked at this. We first looked at this back in 2015-16. We came back and looked again in 2019. But, you know, frankly, there's an issue around leadership, isn't there? Going back in again and again sometimes becomes so soul-destroying. You sort of think, well, rather than just waiting for HMIC to come along every few years and sort of find out that there's a problem, why are police leaders not absolutely making sure that all of those kind of tightening of measures that we've identified in our report, so number one, vetting, number two, proper capacity, so enough staff in your counter-corruption unit, and number three, and this is a really big area that I'm still really concerned about, having proper ICT in place that means you have eyes on all of the activity that's going on your force systems. And one of the things that really concerned us was forces were putting WhatsApp onto force issue mobile phones, knowing that they didn't have eyes on what was going on in WhatsApp because it's an encrypted app.
Yeah, so there's obviously a lot that still needs to be looked at there. If a police officer was really concerned about the behaviour of another officer, what sort of procedures are available to them to report this? And do they work?
Almost every force in the country now has got a reporting line so that police officers can pick up the phone and either in person or I think in some cases anonymously, can feed information into the professional standards department, within which will be the counter-corruption unit. And not only that, what we've seen post our report in 2019 is forces undertaking really important training with their officers. So having conversations with police officers about what's acceptable behaviour, what's not, and the responsibility on people within policing to step forward when they see inappropriate behaviour, whether that's banter in the locker room or a sort of sense that someone's going and visiting a particular victim of domestic abuse regularly with no reasonable excuse. All of those things, I think, are being kind of looked at in terms of training. Clearly, the question is it enough? Has it been quick enough? And is the bar around what is acceptable or what is not acceptable behaviour in policing, has that been set too low?
Palm Sandu, who used to be a Met Police Chief Superintendent and was New Scotland Yard's most senior ethnic minority woman in the force, has said that a lot of women will not report their colleagues because male police officers close ranks.
The police service is very sexist and misogynistic. Unfortunately, the majority of police officers are male, and it's put down to banter. It's put down to, oh, you can't take a joke.
Did you see evidence of that kind of intimidating environment in some forces?
I didn't, but also I know Palm Sandu well. She used to work with me, and I know that what she is talking about is something that she has quite evidently experienced and is something that she is authentically now standing up and talking about very openly. So, I mean, I've had women come forward and make disclosures to me, which obviously I've passed on, female officers who've been domestically abused by their partners, where the forces have felt that it's appropriate to move her out of her post rather than the perpetrator, and, you know, put her in situations where on occasion she can turn up at meetings and he's there. And, you know, these things are mind-blowing, really, and just need to change.
Do you know if police forces have a specific approach to investigating officers who are accused of abusing their partners? A recent investigation by Channel 4 News found that over 120 women have come forward since 2019, saying they, and in some cases their children, have been domestically abused by their police officer partners.
They were all of his mates. He was in there for 15 years. So how are you supposed to have an objective view to a bloke that everyone knows?
14 of them said that officers had failed to investigate their cases. So do you know if there is a specific approach to this?
HMIC, my organisation I've just left, has been asked to look at a super complaint on this very issue. If an allegation is made about a police officer, it must be investigated at least to the same standard as you would expect a complaint being brought by a member of the public about another member of the public. And if there are these sorts of allegations, whether officers from a neighbouring force that don't know any of the parties could come in and do the investigation. I think that is something that happens in some forces, but I don't think it's happening in a consistent way.
Coming up, what do the police need to do to regain the trust of women? Zoe, you've outlined to us the numerous ways in which abusive men can find their way into the police and to some extent be protected there. And I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to this, a lot of women listening to this, who find this all quite scary. What would you say to someone listening who feels they now can't trust the police to protect them?
I would say to a woman who is at risk of harm, who is feeling fearful, you must call the police. You must maintain a confidence that they will turn up. They'll probably turn up pretty quickly if you're subject to a risk of harm or abuse. They will listen to you. They will take you seriously. What happens after that, I think, is something that policing needs to ask itself, whether or not there are the right steps and measures put in place to make sure women and girls in particular are kept safe. There's 1.6 million crimes of domestic abuse relating to women reported to the police every year, and three quarters of those are discontinued, no further action. very early on before it even gets close to a charging decision on grounds that allegedly either victim doesn't support police action or evidential difficulties, i.e., you know, he said one thing, she said another thing. And that simply can't be right. That when women have had the kind of the courage to step forward and report this, and we know abuse will have happened repeatedly before women do report this, you know, for so many of these cases to be falling by the wayside on the decision of police officers so early on is really truly remarkable. And that's why in our most recent report we said immediately there needs to be a change in the process for writing these crimes off, in inverted commas. A rank of at least an inspector must be involved in any decision to discontinue a case of domestic abuse when, you know, let's face it, we know the victim, we know who the perpetrator is, and there are steps that can be taken to bring that perpetrator to justice.
This week, the Met Commissioner, Cresta Dick, announced that there'll be a review.
Public trust has been damaged. People are rightly gravely concerned about what they've seen. And as a consequence, today I'm announcing that we will have an independent person come in and review the Met in terms of its standards and in terms of its culture. How we treat each other and how we treat the public.
Does that seem like a good idea?
Yeah, that's a good start. You know, I think people expect the Met to be taking tangible action because the trust the public have in the police is absolutely fundamental and underpinning the whole legitimacy of policing. If that ebbs away, we are in a very difficult place in London and more broadly in terms of the role of the police.
The day after Cressida Dick's announcement, the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, made a speech to the Conservative Party conference and said there'll now be an inquiry to examine the systematic failures that led to Sarah Everard's murder.
The public have a right to know what systematic failures enabled his continued employment as a police officer. We need answers as to why this was allowed to happen.
Although this isn't a statutory one, so they won't have legal powers to call witnesses. What do you think this should look like?
What I would like to see is a whole new system approach to tackling violence against women and girls, a statutory duty introduced to require all local partners to work together to prevent it happening in the first place, similar to the child protection legislation, funding in place to support that happening, and a relentless focus on prevention and early intervention. And that is really big order stuff. And within that, we'll get onto the misogyny, the boys' attitudes, what's an appropriate relationship and what isn't. All of that we do need to get onto. But let's go for real ambition to stop these crimes happening and to bring about generational change. I don't want us to be in a position in 5 years' time talking about we didn't seize this moment, because there is a momentum here and an absolute requirement to take this seriously.
Your last day as senior inspector fell on the day Cousins was sentenced. You know, you've been in this role for 12 years. How did it feel to end your tenure watching an officer receive a life term for murdering a young woman? And what does that make you think about the possibility of change?
I thought about how I felt at the time when I heard, you know, this whole expression, which is a cliche, saying your blood runs cold. That's how I felt. And actually a sense of despair. And of course, a questioning to myself, well, I've spent 12 years trying to promote improvement in this area. How on earth could this have happened? But it also gave me a renewed kind of burning fire inside me to do whatever I can do now as someone who's outside of the inspectorate and outside of policing, to do anything I can possibly do to make sure that lasting change does happen and that we don't miss this moment.
Zoe, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
That was Zoe Billingham. Lots has been written about this story in the past few days, and I'd really recommend reading Karen Ingala-Smith's piece from The Observer about the 81 women who've died in circumstances where the suspect is a man since Sarah Everard was murdered. Also, Josh Halliday's interview with Les Van Hagen, whose daughter was killed by her abusive partner in 2013. West Midlands Police apologised last month for a number of failings in the case. You can find it all at theguardian.com. If you've been affected by rape or sexual assault, help is available. In the UK, you can call Rape Crisis on 0808 802 9999. In the US, RAIN offers support. Their number is 800 656 4673. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and exec'd by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.